Hello, everybody. Welcome to the French Village podcast. I'm Sarah Longwell, and I'm here with my brilliant friend, Ben Wittes. Excuse me, I sound a little sick because I'm just a little sick.
Not COVID sick. Okay. You sound okay.
Thanks. Yeah, we'll see how my voice holds up.
I was expecting you on the Next Level podcast to sound like death itself, the way JVL introduced you. But you sounded like, you know, like you with a mild cold.
Yeah, well, that's pretty accurate. Okay, so we are starting season 7. We're going to do half of season 7, rocking and rolling through it right now. As you can see, I don't think I spoiled this coming into, oh, maybe I did at some point say they tell you where people end up. And
yeah,
I want to say
it's not subtle.
It's not subtle. It's not like they do those thing at the end where they put up the, you know, and so-and-so died in 19, whatever,
right,
after the nice life. They show you for better or worse. I have super mixed feelings about this season. Before we get into that though, one of the things that's going on in this that we see is Françoise, all grown up, and she's the curator at the Villeneuve Historical Society, is probably
Cultural
what
Center,
it is.
Yeah.
Cultural Center, yeah. And in it, when you go in, they've got the first thing you see is the black and white wind-up camera footage of the November 11th parade. You see Antoine there. And Ben, you had promised a couple episodes ago that you were going to tell us about what the real life thing that event was based on. And then we forgot to do it. But do you have that?
I do. I have it in my hand. So it turns out that, like a lot of things in a French Village podcast, the relationship between the depicted events and actual historical events is super close. I have had my eye open over the last few months for what could be the source incident of the parade. And I found it the other day, or the other week, in the book that has been my main source text for matters historical related to this show, which is Julian Jackson's book, France, the Dark Years, 1940 to 1944. And on page 486, and I apologize to all the Francophones out there. I have no idea how to pronounce the name of this town. It is spelled O-Y-O-N-N-A-X, and I did not check with my French pronunciation coach, Yves Goumont, about pronunciation. So I'm just going to call it Oyonnax, because that's like any effort I would make at approximating it would do violence. So I'm just going to announce the violence in advance. So I'm going to read two paragraphs about this, and I think you will appreciate what the town, what the show did. So the reference here to the Maquis is, you know, which, for those who speak French and have watched the show without subtitles, they don't translate Maquis as Maquis, but it's the woodsman resistance. The people who were hiding in the woods were called the Maquis, and the individuals were called Maquisards. Although the Maquis had little military significance, it did contribute to undermining Vichy's authority in the countryside. The Maquisards assumed the romantic era of bandit heroes, outlawed and persecuted by an unjust society, descending periodically into the towns to dispense a people's justice. One such occasion was the occupation of the little town of Oyonnax in the Jura by the Aisne Maquis on 11 November 1943. 300 Maquisards dressed in uniforms arrived in the town at midday. Watched by an enthusiastic crowd, they paraded to the war memorial, deposited a wreath, and then slipped back into the countryside. The operation, which had been meticulously planned by Roman Petit, was publicized by the clandestine press throughout France and by de Gaulle on the radio. There were no Germans in Oyonnax, but that did not matter. The objective of the operation was to demonstrate symbolically the power and discipline of the Maquis, stating a claim to supplant Vichy's legitimacy in the countryside. When the Maquisards robbed shops, they sometimes provided receipts to show that these were not thefts, but requisitions, even taxes, carried out in the name of the future republic. So that is, I think, down to the day it happened, the source incident or one of the source incidents for the parade. And of course, the big difference between this and the depiction is that there were Germans in Villeneuve, and we needed them to be cleverly removed by Lucien jamming the radio and that stuff. So yeah, I thought that was kind of cool.
That is cool. You know, and I guess I assumed that these kinds of civil disobedience or signals that, you know, the resistance was alive and well, that they must have happened all the time. But maybe this was the one instance of a parade that they based it on.
Well, there may have been others, but this was a parade to lay a wreath at a war memorial on Armistice Day, what we now call Veterans
Day. Right, like the exact
thing. Right, it's the exact thing that they are describing. And also that they were marching in from the countryside as a kind of faux military unit.
That's awesome. Thanks, Ben. Okay, so we've got a ton to discuss, three episodes spanning a great number of decades. But let me just ask you at the top, Ben, since you kind of were seeing this for the first time, what did you think about this conceit of bouncing back and forth between present day sort of, I'm going to say Reconstruction France as they try to, you know, figure out how they muddle forward post-war and, you know, the flash forwards to many of these folks late in their lives?
I don't like it. In some cases, really actively don't like it. Particularly for very different reasons in the case of Lucien, where I think it's really bad, and Müller for historical reasons. And in some cases, like in the case of Hortense, I think they do interesting things with it, and I kind of like aspects of it and dislike aspects of it. Although I have to say, I love that she has a second portrait display entirely composed of self-portraits, or in this case, almost entirely composed of self-portraits. But basically, I think it is an unfortunate choice that doesn't work quite the way they wanted it to. What did you think of it?
Yeah, so I hate it so much. Kill it with fire, hate it. And I one of the reasons I kind of, you know, despite Ducks with Pants accusing me of just, you know, wanting to pursue my other podcast endeavors, one of the reasons I wanted to sort of make sort of short work of this is, look, nobody should give up and everything, but like the best days are behind us in terms of the show. And its quality, the questions that it's asking. I think we get some of our best stuff in the season we just finished. And if I were them, I would have left it there because I don't like any of the... I'm trying to think of a single storyline I like. And it's interesting to me that you like the Hortense in the insane asylum thing, because I'm like, I don't need this weird One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest like commentary on, you know, asylums in the 50s. There's a show in there somewhere, but like, doesn't seem to me to be an interesting place to spend time from this show. I dislike the strike at the sawmill. I don't think that's a particularly interesting way to engage the post-war I don't know, fates of many of the people that we've been following. It's a little more interesting to me than the flash forwards, because at least it's like, okay, well, here's where the rubber meets the road on different ideologies that were able to band together during the war, now kind of breaking apart between the Gaullists and the Bolsheviks. But like a lot of that stuff they've been doing it with the elections and with Berio. And so I feel like there are ways to explore that. That's not this sawmill saga. I don't like this Hubert guy, who is a character in the sawmill, the mean foreman, showing up later as a cop to arrest Schwartz for the murder of Caberni. That seems very unlikely. I don't like seeing the kids all grown up, you know, seeing Gustav and Lenore, like,
Their breakup scene.
I guess it's important to the
years later.
Like, yeah, their breakup scene as adults, and it's like still related. Somehow she's like hearkening back to the day that Gustav, you know, told her to lie to the panel about who left the pamphlets on the bus. And this, I mean, we've had really high stakes this whole show. So like suddenly the stakes seem pretty low, and that seems like a weird thing to be at the nub of their breakup 30 years later. I maybe the only thing I mean, the Hortense too, the old Hortense, who's still, you know, obviously mentally broken, trying to show the painting of Müller at the center. And I mean, there's basically none of it that I care for. The only ones that I find that interesting are Daniel and Tequiero's conversations, because that feels real to me.
All right. So let's...
Him having to... Yeah, so go ahead.
I basically agree with you here. As I say, some of it I mind more than other parts of it. I agree with you about the post-war asylum stuff, you know, being... It's like probably a very interesting subject, but it's, you know, really not about the war. The part I like is old Hortense, years later, having mellowed, but still infinitely narcissistic and infinitely, you know, and unable to disentangle her urge to paint herself with the urge to paint her... you know, her idealized vision of Müller, which is not the way the town sees him, and not the way reality understands him. So I think what we should do is just go through each of these threads. And some of them I have thoughts on, and some of them I'm probably more interested in your thoughts, but let's just go through our major characters who have developments in and talk about what we think about them.
Okay, great. Do you want to start with Hortense?
Oh, sure. Let's start with Hortense. So can I start by saying I don't love the whole Hortense having an emotional break into what is clearly schizophrenia this late in her life. She has gone through her 20s and most of her 30s without delusional systems, though she's clearly a narcissist. And all of a sudden, she's a paranoid schizophrenic. And I didn't find that persuasive. I mean, her paranoia is, I would say, marginally persuasive, but her... You know, her belief that, but she's got some pretty complicated delusional systems going on that I don't think just materialize out of nowhere because some people shave your head. And so I find the whole idea that she's gone insane in the sense that she has pretty improbable. That said, I do think the kind of long-term given that improbable premise, the, you know, the idea that she is locked up in an asylum for many decades, or for what's 3 decades, because this is now the 70s. And in that time, she's basically retreated into painting pictures of herself, is quite delicious. And the idea that she, you know, that Françoise wants to have a exhibition of her stuff, and she picks a fight by injecting a painting of Müller, and then develops a conspiracy theory about it, has the ring of truth to me.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I guess part of me just feels like with this storyline is they were like, you know, she's a great actress. I feel like she could really play crazy. And like, you know, I don't know. It just doesn't feel, I don't know. I'm not getting anything out of it. It adds nothing to the story to me. And I really, really hate this one. I'm bored by it. And I prefer, if you're going to give me a flash forward on Hortense, the kind of, yeah, you're right, the older, mellow, more mellow Hortense striking up an art show in which she's, you know, the obsessiveness of her relationship with Müller is still, you know, in there. Well, that's kind of interesting, because that's a story about how 30 years has passed and this is still, you know, where she lives emotionally. Okay, like that's a place to leave her. That's like, you can tell us, you're telling us something about the character. The part about her in the insane asylum seems to me to be a commentary on 1950s medicine, you know, or psychiatric treatments, right? And like, hey, that kind of shock therapy was bad. Hey, look how these people had no agency and how they were basically, you know, being tortured by doctors who didn't care that much for that. It's like, it's an interesting story. We've seen that story, but like, it doesn't feel relevant to this. And so I can't make myself care about it.
Do you think that there's an element of our negative reaction to this, particularly yours, to a bunch of these, that it really relies on a familiarity and intimacy with post-war France and its disputes that we don't, for example, the depiction of Antoine's death, where, you know, is a kind of meditation on the development of Social Security in France. And by Social Security, they don't mean what we mean by Social Security. They mean a social welfare state more generally and the programs associated with it. But I mean, he goes to a Social Security office and has trouble with the bureaucracy, and then describes how, you know, wants to get help for Genevieve, who is has, you know, Alzheimer's and has lost her card, and they can't give her any assistance with the car without her card, and her guardian is, and all of this is, you know, some kind of commentary on, you know, post-war or 1970s or 80s era French social welfare policy and its pros and cons. And he's very proud of having fought for Social Security. But this all means just nothing to me, because I know a bit about the war. I don't know anything about, you know, French social policy disputes or French, mental health care post-war. And so maybe the show is trying to depict with a bunch of issues the way the war period drifted into the post-war, and it just has no resonance for us because it's depicting, you know, post-war labor disputes and post-war social policy and post-war politics in a fashion that isn't really what we signed up to watch. But if you were a 40 or 50 year old French person would provide a kind of a dramatic continuity with the world that you grew up in that just doesn't exist for us.
But does it? The thing is that it's not that I can't. So you could be right, and that is a thoughtful question that I will think about here and grapple with as we talk. But I guess my gut reaction as I watch, it's not that I'm unfamiliar with the idea. So to me, the Antoine piece is sort of about the way that we don't honor the people who took big risks. Like, it's not just that he felt that he built Social Security. I mean, this is a guy, like, that juxtaposition of him sitting in a bureaucratic office waiting for his ticket to be called, having some 20-something treat him kind of crappily, and, you know, him not really trying to do the, like, you know, he's not doing like a celebrity don't you know who I am, but he is sort of pleading in this way of, I tried to help build this, and like, it's supposed to be better than this, and it's, there's supposed to be more compassion, and I, you know, and he's sort of bewildered by the world that he finds himself in. That is not a story that I think we're unfamiliar with, right? Whether it's the way that VA hospitals treat people, or whether it's, you know, I mean, I've certainly seen a lot of, there's been a lot of commentary, but in America, in Europe, about, you know, you see people with one arm and they talk, you know, they're holding a sign as they beg for money saying that they were soldier, you know, like, I'm just saying that that's not unfamiliar, the idea that we people do amazing things for their countries and their countries fail to sort of care for them in a way that is commensurate with what they've given to their country. Like, I can understand that. I can follow it. I can feel for it. I just, and Antoine's thing is not, I don't hate that one as much as I hate some of the other ones. But like, for example, if the show, we don't really have a soldier, but let's say it was Antoine. Let's say Antoine, after, you know, all that he's seen and all that he's going through, and like a soldier, right? A soldier breaking down. If you want to do commentary on the mental health system in France in the 50s and the fact that it failed soldiers coming back or people who had seen horrible things, but like Hortense, like rich, pampered, narcissistic Hortense, you know, suffering through the system with her just doesn't feel relevant to any kind of conversation. I don't know. I guess that's just how what do you think?
Well, I basically agree with you. Look, these are three of my least favorite episodes in the show. And
yeah.
But I'm trying to understand it from the point of view of the French viewer, which might actually be different from my point of view, and may actually have, it may, there are aspects of the development over, you know, the 50s, they leave out the 60s. It's interesting. There isn't, it goes, there's depictions of the 50s, there's depictions of the 70s, there is depictions of the 90s and 2003. But the 60s, which are, of course, a period of great, you know, turmoil, are basically left out, at least of these three episodes. I'm not quite sure why. I do wonder if somebody sort of more intimate with post-war French social history and the relationship between that period and the war period would have at least a somewhat different reaction than I did to it, and that you did in a more acute way.
Well, let's break it down by storyline to see, like, what are they saying? So I could buy what you're talking about for the strike storyline, right? So the workers at the sawmill who are employed by Schwartz as well as Antoine, and the sawmill workers are people like Suzanne, like Anselm. Okay, Suzanne somehow went from being on the like city council to now working in the sawmill, and so I think that there's, so I, like, I'd buy this one because this one's trying to tell us a few things. One, it's the relationship and the tense relationship between communist socialists, but the labor party types who are trying to fight the are having sort of a normal labor dispute with an owner, and you know they are trying to work through it. And Schwartz is running for mayor, so he doesn't want a strike on his hands. Okay, so that's fine. Like the idea that in the post-war, there's not a lot of work to go around. And people like Suzanne are back working in a sawmill, and they're working horrible hours doing dangerous work.
That there's not a lot of work to go around. There's an incredible labor shortage, and so they're using German POWs. They can't fill enough. They can't fill jobs right fast enough, and so they actually can't hire their way out of this problem. It's the opposite of it's the opposite of lean times. It's the sawmill has a shitload of material to produce and they don't have enough workers to do it. So they're working them under dangerous conditions and then there's this like interesting, like the personnel are interesting, right? Because there's like, Schwartz is definitely the unwilling and very reluctant capitalist, because he kind of identifies more with his workers than he does with his ex-wife and her chums. And meanwhile, Suzanne is a kind of reluctant, she's a commie, but she's been banned from the party because she's living with a cop. And, sort of all of the, and then Antoine doesn't want to be there at all. And Anselm, who is kind of part of the Gaullist resistance and Marie's lieutenant, is now pretty aligned with the commies in the context of the strike. And he's sort of one of the more radical of them. And so it's an interesting... I think it's actually a pretty interesting portrayal of how the different threads of the resistance become politically complicated once you remove the Germans.
Yeah, which is, I guess I was winding up to say that this is one of the storylines that I think like has a place in this, but like to your point where like, okay, I'll buy that this is, this led us somewhere politically and gives us something to chew on. But like Schwartz getting arrested for Kaberny's murder by Hubert, who is the abusive husband of the woman that Schwartz now has his eye on at the sawmill, who, due to flash forwards, you see that he eventually marries.
And who by the time of the arrest is shacked up with.
Yeah, at the time of the arrest. So they're either married or living together. And so, what is that? Right? Like, why?
So I don't know. It doesn't.
Okay. Yeah, you have an answer.
No, I don't really. I mean, to be fair to the show, and you know this, and I don't. Like, it is an underdeveloped plot line. As of the end of the third episode, there may be more that justifies it as we go. Although your skepticism of it suggests to me that the answer, whatever it is not all that satisfying.
I honestly don't remember. I was trying to remember. I don't remember where that leads.
I mean, it's hard to believe for me that Schwartz's ultimate fate in the 50s is going to be a function of his murder of Kaberny in 41 or 42, whenever it was. Although I do think there is maybe the theme that the show is playing with there is that these you know, long buried things that we do in the context of war do have a way of coming back to bite us, which is, of course, more vividly illustrated in season six with all these decisions that Larchet made being tried in a very different context, and that is displayed in Larchet's case in this incident and in this season, where he has to explain himself to his son.
Yeah, and I will say that there's two, both Lucienne and Francoise, grown-up Francoise, and then Daniel and grown-up Tecchiero. They're in two different time. I think old Lucienne. It's interesting. First I'll say those are two of my favorite things to watch. Because we have seen these.
Agreed on one.
Oh, really?
You know, hard disagree on the other.
All right. Well, let me explain myself. Yeah. Now, part of it is that old Lucienne is sort of terrible. Although there is something I kind of like about knowing there's something horribly ironic in Lucienne being the last one around to tell this story. And I find what I like is seeing Francoise grown up and seeing her grappling with her mother's distance. She too is a distant adult and distant from her mother. And there's at least something in there for you, for me to attach to. Where I think the show does well is when you can take the six seasons you've just digested and then you can attach it to a future person grappling with all the scars from all of that, which I think when you have the conversations with the kids, that's pretty apparent. I think when it's the weird just dramatization of things like Schwartz's arrest, there's some other things that do happen in the next episodes I do remember. Where I just don't find them at all satisfying is as a sort of like, here are the scars that have aged. Like the kids break up. I don't find it all useful to that.
Right. I agree with that. Okay, so let's bracket Danielle and Tecchiero, because there's actually some interesting stuff that they're processing.
Yep.
I think the Lucienne plotline from the beginning of the show through the seventh season is one of the weak spots of the show. And the idea that she is... So what we're asked to buy in this is that fresh off her faux suicide attempt, designed to get the priest to come to her house so she can seduce the priest, she is now obsessively scrubbing a statue in the church, trying to get the priest's attention, spying on his confessions to learn to her delight that he's a little bit obsessed with her, and trying to murder her husband, which may or may not be successful as the third episode ends. How this is meaningfully connected to her life of the previous five seasons, I don't know. I really don't know what the show is trying to depict with her. She's gone from at the beginning of the show, kind of good-naturedly vapid and loving being being the object of affection, first from the teacher she helps get killed, and then from Kurt, and then to being like a quite evil and infinitely manipulative, murderous person. Now, granted, Berio has spent all the goodwill that he has acquired from the audience in the first five seasons, in the sixth and this season, he's become quite detestable. But like, what is it that they're trying to depict with Lucienne and then with old Lucienne? Is she an old detached person reflecting on with satisfaction or with like, what is her, what do we know about her reflection other than that she modestly disclaims being a hero? What do we think old Lucienne is reflecting on her period during the war? I can answer that with Larchet, right? What the show is trying to depict here. But like, the Lucienne plotline is incoherent.
So here's my, I think I talked about this in the earlier on in the seasons when you were, you know, you were always a little more, disliked Lucienne a little bit more than I did. And one of the reasons is I think what they do with Lucienne, I think who she represents on the show is people that this thing just happened to. Her energy is a person who has no real, like she's just kind of bumping along. And she is not a bad person or a particularly good person. She's an average, self-interested person, kind of immature, kind of like just attached, you know.
Trying to poison her husband.
So now, so I hate this storyline. I'll get that to a second. But I think that the rationale for Lucienne in the show is like, what is an average person who wanted to live an average life? No great aspirations, but, you know, is just like a fine person. How does this world, how do they live in this world? And I think the answer is that she makes a bunch of just sort of self-interested, you know, incoherent decisions that seem, you know, bad sort of objectively, like, you know, falling in love with the German soldier. But that, like, she's just a normie. And she's just, this stuff all happened to her and it wasn't her fault. And at the end, she's just a person who's kind of empty, looking back, having never taken any real ownership of her life. And in fact, I don't know that this poisoning of Berio is this, but it's like one of the few, maybe like affirmative decisions she seems to make. But of course, it's a horrible one. And she's, the thing with the priest is incomprehensible to me.
Incomprehensible.
I don't know what it's about. The idea that we have to spend multiple scenes, like this is the thing that makes me mad about the show right now is this is precious time. Okay. We spent six seasons, many years. It is precious time. And I'm not against the idea of the flash forwards. There is something satisfying about knowing where people land. There's a lot they can tell us in those. Even though I'm more comfortable back in Villeneuve in the scenes that we've been doing this whole time. And it's jarring to be in 2003 with them. But I don't hate that idea. I just think the execution is awful. And so the time we spend watching her polish this statue only to get us to the point where she eventually starts poisoning Berio with shoe polish. Now I don't like, look, show's creators are going to do a show. I don't have to like all their decisions. But the fact that we have to have a bunch of people kind of be entirely different than the people we've spent with them, like Berio's a monster. Are we to, like, him telling her that he murdered Kurt with a kind of satisfaction that he liked it? Like, is he that person? It feels totally divorced from the person that we've known. Even when he's kind of what I think is the smarmiest, grossest version of himself early on, trying to get her to date him, you know, he's not a monster, and like he is now. And that's not fun, or not fun. That doesn't have to be fun for me, but like, it doesn't feel real. And same with, to your point about Hortense, you know, you're just watching a completely different person, essentially, because now she's schizophrenic and in Madison. So, like, you feel like they lost the thread a little bit.
Yes, very much so. And I think that it's worth contrasting that with Danielle's relationship with Takeru, where there is a real through line between The Trial, which is, I think, one of the show's high moments, and the relationship with his adult son, who finally comes to him and says, hey, wait a minute, were you the father I knew, or were you a monster who helped organize deportations? And by the way, did you steal me? And them having that scene on the bridge where Danielle describes how he came to, you know, have possession of Tequero, and who his mother was and what he did and didn't know. It's, of course, quite incomplete, but presumably that may get, I would hope, that gets a little bit more developed in the last three episodes. But at least we really do understand, you understand the relationship between Danielle Larcher, the mayor, who is kind of involved in a baby theft, or at least not uninvolved in a baby theft, and, you know, is troubled by but participates in the deportations in 42, but then steps back kind of practices medicine and has an ambiguous relationship with the whole thing, and then goes on trial and defends himself, but also confesses. You understand the relationship between that Danielle Larcher and this Danielle Larcher. And I think that's what makes that plot line effective and interesting and compelling. Old Danielle Larcher and his relationship with Tequero is pretty interesting, I think.
I agree. There is the way that they bring it back, right, is that Tequero is now a surgeon, we find out. He has operated on a guy named Goldmans,
who testified against Danielle in his trial.
Yeah. I did wonder how it would come to be that, Tequero wouldn't know anything about the national indignity. It seems like, I mean, I don't know much about that, but I guess it seems to me that would, you know, carry real, that would have been something that would have been part of his childhood. Because instead he's come to understand his father almost as a hero.
You know, but look, he's four or five when it happens. He's living with his aunt. His father is the good guy among the parents. And, you know, Danielle, presumably over the next 10, 15 years, he's a doctor with the, you know, he loses some patients in the short term, but presumably he pulls his life back together. And, you know, maybe Tequero has some, here's some things about it, but it's, you know, it's stuff that happened by the time he'd be old enough to process it. It'd be 1955, 56. And national indignity was not, you know, it was a status. It wasn't a, he didn't go to prison. He didn't get his head shaved in public.
So, I guess that's right. I have no idea. But Tequero seems to be finding this out for the first time, confronts Daniel, and, you know, kind of is like, I was proud of you. You know, because here's the thing. Daniel has shared pieces of this, that his brother was in the resistance, that he went to prison. And so, like, Daniel, I agree. Like, this is a good scene. Daniel confronting this from his son being a grown man now, his son not having any of the benefit of having been there and grappled with any of the complexities that Daniel grappled with. And so he takes it from that hindsight perspective of, you know, you were either a good guy or a bad guy. It sounds to me like you were a bad guy. And Daniel trying to explain the complexity of it is interesting and moving. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about on Daniel is that one of the things we do see in these episodes is we find out, and I want to know how you feel about this because I know you're attached to her and have been wondering what had happened to her, but that Sarah Meyer has died of typhus 3 days after being liberated from Birkenau, and that a woman shows up at the door because she promised Sarah on her deathbed that she would tell Daniel Arche what happened to Sarah and that Sarah thought about him a lot. And instead she has to deliver this news to Hortense, who then has to deliver it to Daniel.
Who doesn't believe
it. But Daniel doesn't know whether or not to believe her because she's a crazy person at this point.
Right. So a couple of things. This is, again, I'm about to bash the show for its handling of the Mueller stuff. So let's start with this being another example of the show getting some very careful historical detail correct. So first of all, for those who don't know the camps, Birkenau is the concentration / labor camp attached to Auschwitz. So Auschwitz is the death camp. Birkenau is the camp where the people who are not immediately killed were, you know, basically it was a concentration camp that was part of the same complex. And it is in fact the case that when a bunch of these camps were liberated, a bunch of people who were in the camps died shortly after liberation. And there were two reasons for this. One was that the camps, this is actually particularly a problem in camps that were like liberated by Americans, that the Americans would bring in food. They had a lot of food. And you went from basically starvation diet to reasonable rations. And people ate a lot. And that's exactly what you're not supposed to do in retrospect when you're on the point of starvation, is suddenly eat a lot of rich food. So a lot of people died. And the second thing is influxes of people brought disease waves. And so it is in fact the case that a lot of Sarah Myers's lived long enough to be liberated and then died in the successive days. And so that is a reasonably completely plausible explanation of what happened to her. And you know, part of me is glad actually that the show had the guts to have Sarah Myers die, because it didn't have the guts to kill Madame Morhage. I mean, she dies, but she dies of natural causes, Servier having gotten her out. And, you know, that's actually not, it sort of is the story of some French Jews. You know, Morhage was French, not, but the death rate among, you know, among non-French Jews like Sarah Myers was about 2/3. And it would have been quite sentimental of the show to have her be one of the people who survives Auschwitz. And so I think the treatment of Sarah Myers is quite good, actually. Now, whether folded into the treatment of, you know, Hortense's mental illness, whether Danielle believes her or not, is a kind of plot twist that you have to sort of accept the she's gone mad aspect of. But I actually think having a woman who clearly has distaste for the Larches show up out of a debt of honor to Sarah to tell this story is a very good resolution to that plot line.
Yeah, she does. The woman does sort of cast off one devastating line in which she says that she believes Sarah really loved Daniel, but Daniel must not have loved her very much.
Yes.
And that felt real in the way that Daniel had his sort of like, I'm helpless against all this, while, you know, imagine you're this person or Sarah and you've been left in this camp, right? It's not like he goes to try to find her.
Right.
So Ben, before we wrap here, I do want to ask you about Mueller, because we do get one or a couple of wild scenes of future Mueller. What did you think about that?
All right. So I have a love-hate relationship with it, mostly hate. So first of all, these scenes confirm what I have suspected for a while, which is that Mueller is in fact a portrayal of a man named Klaus Barbie. And Klaus Barbie, who is known as the Butcher of Lyon, was an SS officer who, after the war, with the help of the Americans, escaped and went to South America and became a torturer for the Bolivian junta. He was sentenced to death in France right after the war. France did not get custody of him until 83, maybe, when he was sentenced to life in prison after a trial. There's an excellent, excellent documentary about Klaus Barbie called Hotel Terminus, which was the name of his headquarters. And Mueller is a... you know, both in season six and, you know, where the Americans help him escape, and in season seven, where he is shown being basically a consultant for Paraguayan torturers, is clearly a kind of modeled on Klaus Barbie. That said, this is a part of the
show. Why do you think he's in a wheelchair?
Yeah, so this is the part of the show where the creators' anti-Americanism really gets the better of them. And, you know, so far the anti-Americanism of the show is basically depicted by the U.S. Army being a bunch of boors and, you know, a kind of background unpleasant condition. But this is a show that gets a huge amount historically right. And they depict something in the case of Mueller that is just outright fantasy. So I mentioned this last week, but it really comes to fruition in a weird way in this. So it is true that the American Army helped Klaus Barbie escape. It is not true that the American Army helped Klaus Barbie escape to America, become an American citizen, and then become a CIA officer. And Mueller is in this Paraguayan dungeon supervising torture, representing the CIA. That did not happen, not with Barbie, not with anybody else, to my knowledge. This is like a kind of post-Abu Ghraib, you know, post-CIA secret prisons fantasy of the CIA using Barbie as a kind of, like, it's like Barbie on steroids. The true story of the U.S. engagement with Klaus Barbie was bad enough. But this is a show that gets all kinds of things exquisitely historically accurate, and they have just fantasized the idea that SS people were becoming torturers for the U.S. government. That shit never happened. And, like, it's weird that a show that pays the kind of attention to history would just kind of fantasize something like that. And I think it's, I don't know if it's a sort of self-conscious inaccuracy or if it's a weird oversight. I don't want to speculate about what's behind it, but I thought it was really beneath the creators of the show.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Next week, we're going to do the final three episodes. I promise we'll give ourselves enough time that we can really do not just those three episodes, but some overall reflections on the full show, and even, I think, a little bit more discussion about how it relates to the time that we might be living through right now. But with that, thanks, Ben. I appreciate it. We'll see you guys next week.
Thank you. And in the meantime, Edith, take us home.
Nous nous aimions bien tendrement, comme s'aiment tous les amants.